Welcome to the ERB podcast, where we love to talk about books. At the ERB, we believe that life and faith is nurtured by the habit of reading. We've invited a diversity of writers, thinkers, and leaders to talk with us about the books they're reading, because reading matters, and so do great conversations. C. Christopher Smith is the founding editor of the Englewood Review of Books. Joel Wentz is our producer, and I'm your host, Jen Pollock-Michelle.
This episode is sponsored by the new book, A Holy Haunting, by Sam Kim. Learn more at aholyhauntingbook.com.
So great to be with you guys today to chat on the ERB podcast. I am going to tell our listeners a little bit about you. I'm here with Reverend Dr. Sam Kim, who is the co-founder and senior minister of 180 Church near Union Square in downtown Manhattan. He is a Harvard-trained ethicist and the author of the forthcoming book, A Holy Haunting, Why Faith Isn't a Leap, but a Series of Staggers from One Safe Place to Another. Greatest subtitle ever, by the way. I love that. Sam lives in New York City with his wife, Lydia, and his two sons, Nathan and Josh. Welcome, Sam.
Thank you for having me.
And I am also here with Gregory Coles. He is an author, speaker, and scholar. He was born in upstate New York and was raised on the Indonesian island of Java. Greg holds a PhD in English from Penn State, and his most recent book is called No Longer Strangers, Finding Belonging in a World of Alienation. And I do have to say that I was honored to write the foreword for your book, Greg.
I was even more honored to have you write the foreword for my book, Jen.
CT Book Award winner of the year.
Let me tell you, this woman's a big deal.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and how many people have stopped you in this conference center? Listeners don't know, but Greg and I had lunch right before the podcast recording, and he was stopped at least five or six times by people that he knows. So we know who the famous person is here in this conversation. Well, it's great to be able to chat with you today, and we're going to be talking about loneliness and community. And so I'm really just curious, as you are, tell us what you're seeing in your own life, in your communities. What are you seeing about loneliness? And do you think, in particular, that something new is happening compared to 5, 10, 20 years ago? Maybe related to the pandemic, but, you know, maybe having other factors. So, Sam, do you want to start?
Yeah. I think one factor, if you go back, based on the data, if you go back 25 years, since 1999, the rate of suicide ideation has increased 30%, which is an alarming amount for about 25 years. But we don't want to also miss the forest for the trees. Suicide ideation is one part, the culmination, the battle between depression and loneliness. And so eventually you get to that, it goes from bad to worse. But the obvious factor is the advent of social. Mm. When you're comparing your bloopers to others' carefully curated highlights, despair is inevitable. Mm. And so, you know, there's like a Paris filter on Instagram. Mm. So it makes everything more hyperbolic in many ways. So that's one major thing that we're seeing from a public health lens.
Mm-hmm. It literally a Paris filter. That is actually
there is a Paris
thing.
Filter, yeah.
And does that just give it a sort of subdued
nostalgia?
Okay.
Like a homecoming to make your moment better.
Yeah.
I like to call Facebook, I think it should be corrected to in your Facebook. it's really, my life is better than yours, because you're not highlighting vulnerability, failure, or fear. You're highlighting success. And so, as a microcosm, it really brings out someone going in their moment of weakness or depression, loneliness, I'm on the struggle bus alone. Mm-hmm. I'm the only one going through this. When it's part of the human story. Mm.
Just because we're on the subject of Facebook, since you brought that up, I was interested to learn recently that when you look at social media use, like, you actually see a lot of addiction in the boomers.
Yeah.
You know, we often are talking about social media and its influence on the young, but we're seeing that in the boomers as well, which I'm assuming is probably not your demographic that you're working with in Manhattan. So.
It's not, but I mean, based on studies, like, for example, I really, at Harvard, I was really interested in, when I was researching the loneliness epidemic, what really got my attention was the UK government appointing a loneliness minister, mm-hmm. because the seniors haven't spoken to someone in like a month, and it was affecting their health in the worst way possible. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you could see why they would want to go anywhere where there's accessibility to community would exist, even if it's superficial to a certain extent. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Craig, tell us about your experience.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that's been really interesting to me about social media as a phenomenon is the way that it makes proximity irrelevant to like who my people are, because you can have people who are far away, right? The great thing about social media and, you know, various forms of long distance connection are I can leave somewhere and be like, oh, it's okay, we'll keep in touch. You can still be my people even though we're far away. But that means that then I'm sort of absolved of the responsibility to then have my people also include the people who are right there with me. And so we live in a world where the connections I'm trying to make are, you know, the person I'm tweeting at while I sit on a bus surrounded by people who I will never talk to, try to ignore the existence of, you know, ideally we will not utter a word to each other while we're right there with each other. And it seems like a really unique historical moment in the sense that you can have a person who's physically surrounded by loads of other people and says, I feel so alone because I feel separated from this sort of abstract social media ideal that I have, that as Sam's saying is not even like a real person, it's like a curated vision of someone. And so we substitute actual in-flesh human connection for this sort of disparate idea of a connection with each other.
What is the data, or, you know, how do we say, how are we to understand connection differently, right? Why can't we substitute digital connection for embodied connection?
Well, there's
as Christians, we kind of have
But there's actually a quantitative study on why. For example, the whole conundrum of the modern era is that the first conundrum is modern urban density. We live with more people in human history. And there are more people on the planet than ever. But if you go to a place like New York, you're walking with 23 million people around you, but it only seems to compound the loneliness. So it's like, but why? Why are you lonelier if you're around more people? And then the digital connections through social, we have the most access to anyone. Like Home Alone, the movie, I saw it again. Like, you would never lose Kevin, because you would DM him and be like, dude, where are you? Like, oh, I'm here at home.
He'd find his iPhone.
He would find his iPhone or something. So more accessibility and proximity, yet there's greater loneliness, depression in the history of humanity. And the study says online interactions and connections cannot replace face-to-face interactions, which is good news, I think, for the church.
Yeah.
Particularly because that's what we're called, the ecclesia, we're called the community of God sent. But I think we've lost the art of that in many ways. Like your book, right? The great call of our time is not productivity, it's presence. But we lost part of that. What it means to be present with someone, particularly in the loneliness epidemic. Actually, when I was at Harvard, the UN asked me, after reading a piece I did called and it was for CT, and it said, why the loneliness epidemic is a historic gospel opportunity. It was plain gospel. The UN picked it up. Harvard said, we're going to share this because it does mitigate loneliness to a certain degree, and it's actually a solution. So the UN said, why not try to create a policy where all faith communities are mobilized to try to mitigate loneliness. And it was like, people are so desperate, so lost at where we're at right now. They don't mind the gospel at all. It sounds like good news to them in some way. I was astounded because when they shared it, Harvard Medical School shared it with all their posts, I'm like, I didn't send this to them. They found it on their own and summarized it. And I was like, that's God saying something about the opportunity of the power of community in the church, the ecclesia. We need to go back to the origin of that calling. And it's right here, right now.
Why is church such a unique expression of human community? Or how, like, I guess in its let's talk about it in the ideal, and then let's talk about it in the reality of it. Greg, you're laughing.
I just think it's funny how stark the distinction feels between like the church and the ideal, and let's talk about the church and the reality too while we're at it. Am I allowed to toy with the question? Because
sure,
I wonder if maybe part of the brilliance of church is that it has to be that messy, imperfect thing. Like the idea of the pristine church as it could be would be something more like the social media church of like, all we'll ever give you are the, you know, the correctly curated sound bites and, you know, the properly edited. Well, it's social media. Nobody edits properly. But like, we'll give you this curated vision, and the being in person, the receiving from all the senses simultaneously, and even just the power of embodiment itself. I mean, if you think about how different it is to sit with someone. So like, if I'm sitting here next to you, as indeed I'm delighted to be doing.
Yes, we're not on Zoom. That's
cool.
Face to face.
I could close my eyes and plug my ears and, you know, not be like smelling or feeling you in any particular way, and yet be like, I am with people.
Yeah.
But if I'm Zooming with you, if I close my eyes and plug my ears, like, I might as well not be on Zoom because I have lost all the, I'm just sitting in front of my computer, you know? And so there's something about the embodiment itself that creates the possibility for imperfection, but it also creates the possibility for being.
Yeah.
There is no pure being with one another when you're far apart. You can only be with one another to the degree that one of you is talking, to the degree that you can see each other, to the degree that you can hear the other person breathing. Once you lose those sensory inputs, if you're not together, there is no being.
Yes.
But when you're in person together, there is simply being in the same space and the power of simply being.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that the call to be in community with one another, the call to be enfleshed with one another, is fundamentally part of what church is about.
Yeah. And I think the answer is in Advent, in the incarnation. Jesus came in the flesh to be present among us. He dwelt among us. And his presence changed who he discipled, who changed the world. And he came in human form to be in close proximity and intimacy. And he lived with those guys, you know? There was nothing edited or hidden, it was messy. And if you really think about it, the guys didn't really learn that much. Because in terms of orthodoxy, they were like, what? Like, they were always lost. And on the day of the resurrection, they doubted the resurrection. They told the women, you're talking nonsense. But they heard it for 3.5 years, that what would happen. But what changed them wasn't what Christ, the great sermons of Christ, it was his presence. And I feel like that's part of why the gospel is good news. It's our presence and his presence in us when two or three gather in the name. The ecclesia takes place and we become that community, which is a triune community, a Trinitarian vision of community. God himself is a fellowship. Really powerful quote from Daryl Johnson, Experiencing Trinity, professor at Regent College way back. He said, at the center of the universe is a relationship. At the center of the universe is a fellowship. For this, you were created, and for this, you were redeemed. I heard that. I was like, oh my goodness. Relationship. That's what the church is supposed to be, relationship.
What I find really striking, because, I mean, when you talk about loneliness, if you were to just survey a group of people, like, do you want to be lonely? No one would say yes, of course. Like, I want connection. I want community. I don't want to be lonely. And yet, there are costs involved with belonging.
Yes.
And I find that people are divided in their desire for community. Mm-hmm. I want and I don't want.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about what you see in terms of the people that you know and even in your own self? I want and I don't want community. I lean toward it and then I resist it. And then how do we address that? How do we actually address the divided desire that we bring to the notion of community and its cost, the cost of belonging?
God has to teach us to want.
You're hilarious.
Well played. Well played, Sam.
You can edit this out.
You know, one of the things that I think is so interesting about people's desire to have real community, to have real belonging, is that what I think they want on some level is people with whom they can be totally vulnerable, right? People with whom they can be entirely known, the kind of people who you don't have to like clean up your house before they get there and then you wait to wash all the dishes and argue with your kids until after they leave, you know?
Yeah.
You have to delay all the disciplinary activity until they're out at the house. And just like the people who you have to like put your life on pause for and then be like, now we'll be together. Okay, once you leave, now life as it actually exists can begin again. And to be in community with somebody who actually experiences all of your life requires you being vulnerable enough to be like, have at all of my life. And so I think there's an incredible discomfort in the invitation to vulnerability. I know sometimes I'll be talking to people who are like, I just feel like I don't have really, really deep friendships. You know, like, I don't know what to do about finding those deep friendships. And I'll ask, like, who do you process the parts of yourself that you're really ashamed of and don't know what to do with? And who gets to see the part of your life that you don't want anybody to see? And they're like, well, nobody. That's the whole point. And I'm like, that may be related to the loneliness. But until you're willing to be at least vulnerable enough to invite somebody into that space, I don't know that you'll ever have the kind of connection that you're longing for.
Mm.
It's contrarian because the desire is dualistic. You want a safe community, but then again, you don't want a soft community.
Mm-hmm.
To the calling of real intimacy is into me see.
Mm.
And I mean, then you have to be the slob you are. And if you can be a slob in front of this person, then you're showing who you really are. You're human. And I think that's the call of humanity. And so you're scared, but you're hopeful at the same time.
Mm.
And it's a dualistic tension there. And I think that tension is important because it says, I have to go further. I don't know if I can. That's why we need people around us to push us, to encourage us, to lift us. And sometimes, you know, be like, dude, you're being a butthead. Right? And not be afraid of conflict and, you know, euphemize and be perfunctory about this. I think those are very few to find. And Jesus had three, we could see in terms of his numbers. But we have to find those people.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
It's hard work. It is hard work.
Yeah. Practice.
Yeah.
There is a lot of practice, I think, involved in community. And I think we often just even sort of forget that as a category of the Christian life. Like, you can practice your way into something, not just something you already know. Like, I know this, so therefore I practice it. But I practice this in order to know it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think community, at least as I feel it to be in my own life, it's something I continue to have to practice my way into. Practice my way into a desire for, practice my way into a desire, a knowledge of how to even do this thing, you know? Practice apologizing for when I fail to do it well.
The psalmist writes in Psalm 42:7 that deep calls unto deep. Sam D. Kim in A Holy Haunting suggests that many confuse this deep longing with a form of chronic anxiety or something that has gone wrong when it is in fact a holy haunting of the presence of God. Deep calling unto deep is nothing other than the voice of God echoing from eternity. Perhaps our culture's current crushing opioid crisis, mental health epidemic, and the rise of Tinder are all manifestations of this holy haunting gone horribly wrong. Clear residual evidence of not only the existence, but its prevalence in human experience. For more, visit aholyhauntingbook.com.
What do you guys think are the practices? Like, if you break it down and say, okay, that person who says, I'm lonely, what are the practices and habits that they have to take up? We're a pastor in Manhattan. I'm, you know, a congregant. I'm lonely. What do they actually do? And you talked about vulnerability, disclosing of the self. But what does it look like on a daily, weekly, monthly basis?
One thought that comes immediately to mind, and then Sam can give all his good thoughts. He can use big words like euphemize.
The English PhD.
One thought that comes immediately to mind for me is I think so often the experience of loneliness can sort of turn us inward and say, like, let me think about all the things I need. Let me think about what I wish other people were offering to me. Why aren't other people offering these things to me? And I wonder if, I think that deprives us both of the opportunity to see ourselves as being on mission, which I think is not a complete solution to loneliness, certainly, but is in some way related to the sense of, like, moving from a life that feels sort of floating and aimless to a life on purpose. But it also, when we're just turned inward, we miss the opportunity to look around and say, who else is lonely?
Yeah.
And see that the more we think of loneliness as a me problem and don't recognize that the other 76 people on the bus also not talking to us may also be lonely, the more we miss the chance to make meaningful connection that could solve more than one loneliness problem at the same time. And so I think the practice of turning outward and saying, okay, if I feel lonely, how can I help provide for someone else's need for human connection in the context of their loneliness? And it may not be the person I would have chosen. I think often we're lonely because we have this idealized image of, like, here are the friends I need, here's the family I need, and I'm, you know, not interested in human connection unless it's the one that I'm looking for. And so in, like, a quasi-online dating situation, it's as if we're dating around for the right friend, and all the people we're swiping left on are over there feeling like, I'm still super lonely over here. So maybe to make a concrete practice of just seeking out people who seem to be lonely and saying, hey, can I help provide some human community for you, whether or not it's the one I want?
Yeah. Oh, that's so good.
Or don't be in such a hurry to make a friend. Right? I mean, who are your friends? People you practice presence with. Like Dallas Willard, right? Ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. The addiction to productivity, addicted to competition. Like, I just read a new study about Gen Z, how they're different from millennials, how they're overwhelmed by activity. Because if they're not doing it, they're losers. If they're not have something in their calendar, they're falling behind. If they're not working hard in their schoolwork, then they're falling behind and not measuring up. So you're always in a hurry. You're always trying to make something or going through something. When are you going to just be? How could you even have a friend if you don't even know the state of your own soul?
Yeah.
So I think you have to slow down and just be. Don't have an agenda. Be with people. You never know. Those people could be your best friend. Because it should be about proximity and intimacy that you are with people. And then that eventually builds. I think we have to have the courage, like, I'm a Gen Xer. We have to have the courage to endure silent, awkward pauses. Because that's what people try to eliminate. Like, they want, you know, How I Met Your Mother dialogue in their everyday relationships. But those are 100 writers writing those lines. The awkward pauses say something about the sanctity and the sacredness of who we are. And that we're willing to endure that space, occupy that space of the ordinary, and let the sacred come when we're together. And that space between us closes. I think that it's a beautiful thing, too, at the same time. I remember when I was in high school, like 94, 95, when I had to call a girl I was interested in, I had to talk to their mom, their sisters. I had to talk to their dad.
In order to even get them on the phone.
Get them on the phone. And they would quiz me on, like, what are your intentions for my daughter? What's your SAT score? What college did you get into?
Oh,
it's like a job interview. And then the siblings would be like, you have a boyfriend, right? It's like,
yes.
And then the girl would be like, oh my God, get off the phone, you idiot. Like, there was no way we could ghost these people that we were living with at that time because we knew their families. Mm. It was the awkward presence that we encountered. It's a beautiful thing. And that art, I think, has to be reintroduced.
Yeah.
The art of human connection. It's okay. We're human. We're awkward. We're weird. Everybody's normal until you get to know them anyway. And, you know, and I think that's part of it. Going back to just basics, authentic connection and community. Mm-hmm. Nothing really like a formula or anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. If I could add one more concrete practice, and it may sound sort of counterintuitive, but I think practicing intentional solitude and time alone with God is really valuable, because I think often when we try to solve loneliness the wrong way, as I think we do with a lot of our human problems, right, we're always casting about for solutions, but often the solutions we find are the wrong ones. And if we're afraid of solitude, and so we try to fill the space with people, and we fear the moment the people leave, because then all of a sudden we're sort of stuck with ourselves and we discover how much we hate being alone with ourselves. Mm. It seems to me that taking intentional stock of that time and asking, like, who am I when I stand alone with, you know, only God for conversational company? Can I be okay in that space? So that when I'm with people, the thing I'm doing is not trying to fill the void and make sure everybody yells loud enough that I forget how much I can't stand the sight of myself. But maybe I can be sufficiently okay with me and Jesus that when I enter into human community, I can do it in a way that's more purposeful and rich and the kind of community that it's meant to be. And so maybe starting in solitude will set us up well for the kind of connection we really need.
Henry Nouwen says something about that. He says that we are the prodigal every time we search for love where we cannot be found.
Mm.
And the truth is, community itself won't resolve loneliness. They'll mitigate some of it. But the greatest calling of our lives is to be the beloved. And I think what Greg's saying is, be the beloved. Drink deeply of the Father's love for who you are. And that roots us into the value as the beloved. And I think from that, it overflows to relationship. I think that's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of a book that Chris Smith, our editor, just gave to me, and I think he's actually probably mentioned on the podcast, but Rowan Williams' Where God Happens, Discovering Christ in One Another. But it's the Desert Fathers bringing us to the idea of, like, how is the practice of solitude and silence actually we feel of those to be individualistic disciplines, but they're actually socially minded towards the community, and they're actually restore us into community. I think that's really beautiful. I'm curious about what you think about the role of the church in terms of how do we help people, how do we nurture a desire for community, a sense of what a realistic experience of community is and will be. Because I think I see that people, and you mentioned that, you know, that I want my ideal friends. I don't necessarily really want community, which is like the odd uncles and, you know. So how do we, how do our churches also just provide connection for people? What ways do we re-envision that, especially post-pandemic, when people haven't gotten themselves back to church in many respects?
Bonhoeffer talks about that in Community, how our idealized version of community is what kills community. I think the first thing is, I think the theological aspect of teaching is we have to give people permission and let people know up front, we're a beautiful mess, all of us. Mm-hmm. We're broken, and Christ's strength is made perfect in our brokenness. I think that theology of power of brokenness has to be integrated deeply for the emotionally health, the foundation for there to be real community. Also, I think that people are so flaky sometimes. You gotta...
And that's when you call them a butthead, right?
Yeah, you call them a butthead and other things. But, I mean, the church, they were under persecution, and it said, don't give up the habit of meeting together.
That's right.
So don't be a wuss, right? Yeah, it's gonna be humdrum sometimes. It's going to be like, dude, why am I talking to you? Like, sometimes you're going to be moody. But the consistency of showing up together, I believe, is the practice of presence. And inadvertently, through the seasons of transitions, and that's where Christ, I think, is formed mostly deeply within us, in seasons of change and transition, that's when the community catches us in transitions, failure, grief, loss. And that's when friendships are built and formation takes place. Mm-hmm. So that practice of presence consistently, a habit, I think is so important.
Yeah. I think, too, there's so much value in the experience of messiness in Christian community. And I feel like so often the way we try to do church together consists of trying to, like, eliminate as much messiness as possible. I mean, Sam, you mentioned earlier, like, the relevance of the incarnation to this conversation. Yes. The fact that Jesus is like, hey, let me take a human form. And I was reminded recently of the tradition that some... what are those things called? All the little figures in Advent. Thank you. Okay. The Nativity. Appreciate you, Jen. The Nativity tradition I was reminded of recently is how some nativities will have that little guy off in the corner pooping. Are you guys familiar with this tradition?
No.
So it's, I'm pretty sure, I mean, don't quote me on, well, it's a podcast, so I guess you're stuck quoting me.
You are being quoted.
Yeah, well, okay, so maybe I'm wrong, people listening to this podcast. If so, I hope you'll report back to me later. But what I have been told is that there are some traditions that exist where there's an extra figure that you're supposed to add to the nativity of a guy off in the corner pooping, and the whole idea of it is to force you to remember the necessarily embodied nature of the incarnation, mm-hmm. and to remember that embodiment is an inherently messy and unpleasant experience, that even within the beautiful scene that we imagine, there is always the obscene, right, the thing that's supposed to take place off scene, and a story like Jesus coming is certainly a story that we often have this very idealized vision of, it, and yet in its reality is so messy. And so it makes me wonder, when we gather together to be in Christian community, how much are we trying to hide away or paper over the very things that are fundamentally human experiences that are part of what we're meant to bring together? I've become increasingly suspicious anytime I enter a musical worship experience and the worship leader says something like, we just want to leave our burdens at the door. And I'm always like, I don't want to leave my burdens at the door. Like, I got to bring them somewhere. And if I'm not supposed to deal with them with you people, I don't know what the crap I'm doing here, you know?
Oh, that's really good.
And so it just seems to me that we need to bring in the messy, not to try to eliminate it, not to create this really tidy church space in which we imagine ourselves not having a real human life, but a space that we can actually enter and be really human in the same place as one another and say, here we come to the same table in our messy human bodies to eat from the same bread and drink from the same cup. And in the end, I think more and more when I think about the experience of church that I long for, I just want to show up with a bunch of really messy people and eat the body of Christ and drink the blood and be reminded. Which is super messy. Yeah. I feel like that's the whole idea. And just be reminded that that's the journeying through this mysterious mess is what Jesus came for, and it's what we're called to.
There is no Eucharist without breaking, right?
Yeah, right.
It's messy. The bread, the crumbs on the church carpet, being poured out. It's a messy, beautiful idea of authenticity. And people talk about the Adventus, but what about the exitus, the exit from heaven, the departure, the great departure before the great revival? We have to, you want to arrive to homecoming, you want to arrive to friendship and community, authentic community, you have to depart from a few things.
Yeah.
Conveniences, preferences, idealized visions, and embrace the mess. Mm-hmm. And just be. Mm-hmm. Just be. And that's hard. And I don't like it.
Yeah.
And I'll never like it. But that's why I need the Spirit to work in me, and I need people around me. Because there are two things I learned from planning a church, being a pastor for about 20 years. You can't completely eliminate human pride, and human stupidity. That's why we need community. We need to mitigate it at least. We need to limit it a little bit. And that's why I need it, because I can't ever eliminate completely my pride and stupidity, because I think I see, but I don't all the time. So I need others to see for me, and I need others to limit those things. I mean, we've seen the destruction of the church, American church empire recently, because those two things were not integrated into the church culture.
Interesting that you can be in a church community without community. You know, what we've seen with some of the scandals in church, in various churches, where what essentially happens is that the leader becomes isolated.
Exactly.
Right? Sin thrives in isolation. So I'm also interested, I don't know if you guys have read Bob, is it Smetana? Do you guys, he's a religion news service. He wrote a book on church, institutional church, and I'm forgetting the name, and normally this is when our producer would give me the name on the chat in Zoom, but I don't have it, but I'm sure Joel will include it in our show notes. But he brings up research about how in various cities across the U.S., people have tried to sort of configure church but not have it be church, you know, so have some sort of congregation. But they don't really have a mission. They don't really have a vision, but they are simulating the experience of church community. It's so interesting to think about how we do. I mean, I think that speaks to the longing that we have for it. I'm curious, just to turn to our final question, since we're a podcast about books, why don't you share some titles, fiction, nonfiction, that have inspired your vision for community? Maybe also animated your desire for community. So it could be a novel. Could be, you know.
I have a wacky one.
Okay.
I have a wacky one.
Yeah, please share.
Not a book, but I guess part of it. It's an essay from Stephen King.
Oh.
Body, called. One line says, "The most important things are the hardest to say."
The most
important things are the hardest to say.
And
he goes to say, you want to say them, and you thought, like, feel like crying because they're so important, but people look at you in a funny way, and it costs you dearly. And you don't say it, not because you don't, it's because you don't have anyone worthy or safe to say them to. For me, I dream of the ecclesia becoming, for seekers, for agnostics, for believers, to be a community, a diverse community, where people, we can be worthy of the Imago Dei, they deposit that Imago Dei to us, and say the most important things, which can be fear, grief, many things, but it can be a depository, a treasure box of those things, because David says in the Psalms, right, God keeps a record of our tears. And I hope that's the vision and community that we can become, to honor people's tears, honor people's hearts and their stories.
I also have a somewhat offbeat source of inspiration. So there's primarily a children's author named Brian Jakes. He's a UK author, most famous for writing a children's book series called Redwall, which is about mice and squirrels.
Yes.
You're familiar with Redwall.
My son has read Redwall.
Oh, how fabulous.
Yes.
Back in the day, I was quite the Redwall aficionado.
Okay, interesting.
But Brian Jakes also wrote this other book, and then there's a sequel later. The sequel's not as good. They never are. But a book called Castaways of the Flying Dutchman.
Not to
spoil too much of the plot, but you end up with these two main characters, a boy and his anthropomorphic talking dog, who are saved from death and then blessed by this angel so that they live forever. And because of this, they then sort of go around the world from place to place, and they just kind of will enter a community and then find some need that exists, some good deed they can do. But obviously they can't stay too long because they never age. And so if they stay in a place too long, people will start to realize they'll never age. And so there's a the final part of this book, they're in this community, they go and there's like, they're beginning to address this problem, and they become really beautifully, deeply embedded in this community, and they love all these people really well, and they're in their lives. And the thing is, you know, from the main character's perspectives, you know all along, like, they're not going to be able to stay. And yet, everybody in the community is receiving them as if, like, oh, you're going to be here forever. And so it's really beautiful and heartbreaking to see them form these connections, and then, you know, at the end, they have to just hop a train without saying goodbye to anybody, and they just disappear off to the next adventure. And it strikes me in thinking about that, that when we think about our experience of human community, I feel like so many of us are often looking for the final solution to community. Like, oh, I will find these right people and they will solve my need for connection, and then they'll be with me for the rest of my life, and then I won't have to worry about it again. And unless you are the right person to be in community with me for the rest of my life, I'm not interested, because I'm only looking for the final solution. And I wonder if the kind of community, the kind of intimacy that God wants to offer us relationally, to meet us in the midst of our loneliness, is often a more open-handed thing than we want to receive it as. Like, we're looking for something that we can clutch and cling to and freeze in ice and be like, yep, this is permanent, this is forever. And God is like, let me give you daily bread. Let me give you enough intimacy, enough belonging, enough community for today. And tomorrow, we'll come back to that question again. But I think so often maybe we miss out on the daily gifts because we are only wanting God to give us the kind of community that we want, which is something that feels sort of sufficiently safe, sufficiently trustworthy, sufficiently permanent to us. And I wonder if there's something in the gift of the ephemerality that God might want to give. So, Castaways of the Flying Dutchman by Brian Jakes. You may read it and think, well, this is just like B-grade children's fiction, and you wouldn't be wrong. But it has still shaped the way I think about community all the same.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm really appreciating this conversation. Thank you to both of you for just sharing your time with us here at Urbana and talking over the announcements in this lovely convention center. Greg Coles, again, is the author of No Longer Strangers. Remind me of the subtitle.
Finding Belonging in a World of Alienation.
Finding Belonging in a World of Alienation. And Reverend Dr. Sam Kim, his book is coming out, A Holy Haunting. And I'll let you say the subtitle.
Why Faith is in a Leap, but a Seer Staggered from One Safe Place to Another.
Love it. Such a great subtitle.
So good. So good.
Hey, thanks so much for being with us, guys.
Thanks so much for having us.
If you enjoyed this conversation and you would like to learn more, please visit our website, englewoodreview.org, where you'll find plenty of book reviews, reading lists, and author interviews. And of course, you can subscribe to this podcast through your favorite podcast provider and share it with your friends. Thank you again for listening. Here's to energizing reading today.